Thank you very much, Jay. We really appreciate the fact and thank you for the opportunity to address you today and close off on gender equality. Much you think the two researchers, and I just want to introduce you to the two researchers, so all the difficult questions can be addressed to them. That's Tian Deploy and Francois Calvi, and that's our team. Madam Chair, I've sent you a very short summarized version of my presentation that was part of your packages. The name of it is Affirmative Action Perspectives on Progress. In that, you will see that I have four specific headings. You have it in front of you. In the first place, Employment Equity Report and National Policy. White, female, women and affirmative action, young people and affirmative action, and white males and the code of good practice. I just want to refer to one or two of those because some of that you have, and it's not necessary for me to go through it because I think you have it and you, I will not go through it, especially in the light of your time limitations. According to, if you look at young people and affirmative action, that's the third point there. There I have a quite full explanation why we believe that young people must be exempted from affirmative action. You will also see that is one of my recommendations to this committee to further look at that. The information on that you have, so I'm not going to go through that. In the second place, and that is also something that I look at more in depth in this presentation, and I have much information on this, more information if you want. I can see even more, and that is about the idea of a code of good practice for affirmative action, especially to an additional code of good practice, especially to make sure that companies stay within the Employment Equity Act so that they don't go further than the Act requires. And that is also in there, and I'm not going to focus on this at this stage. It's in there. There's questions and answers on this. And you are more than welcome to at any time interact with me. And that is also a second proposal of mine, then, that the Desk Portfolio Committee look at the whole issue of a possibility of a code of good practice. But I have more information on that as well. Two issues in the my submission that I said that I will give you more information on is in the one, first place, the Employment Equity Report and National Policy. And then the second place, white females and affirmative action. Now, of course, Employment Equity Report and National Policy is of critical importance. In all respect to the member that proposes that our submission that we just started this morning, the fact is, I also heard from another member that it is this this commission's hearings is actually based on the Employment Equity Report and to look further on that. So the fact of the matter is that it's critical to look at the statistically effective statistics that used in the Employment Equity Report so that you can know the source that you use. Can you use it as the a source to determine national policy? Now what I've done is, and I have a summary of that, but I also, it's in the form of a handout to report to you the truth about employment equity in South Africa. This specific report is an in-depth study on this. I'm going to only present you with a much shorter version of that. But there's an in-depth study. Please go through it. The long and short is what this report, I just want to make sure that every one of you receives, because I don't have an additional presentation on this. This document you can go through, it actually shows that there's much more progress on employment equity than is generally accepted. In the second place, it also shows that the statistic base of the employment equity reports are very, very, very shaky. And you can look at that. Now, I want to concentrate, and I will also address the first point of that, in that I want to concentrate on the whole issue of white women and affirmative action, because that is, of course, at this stage so important issues do debate it a lot. The media is actually debating it a lot. The chairperson of the Employment Equity Commission said that is the one thing that came out from the Employment Equity Report that is very important. And therefore, I want to look more in depth to that. He's saying the only people that have had meteoric rise are white women. It's simply not true. And I just want to show that because the chair of the Employment Equity Commission clearly brought wrong information in the public arena, and that's important just to rectify that. Now I bring you then to the additional report that I have, that I also handed out, and I promise you in my presentation that I will give it to you. Its name is The Truth About White Women and the Affirmative Action in South Africa. Also, Chair, unfortunately, because of the time limit, it's impossible for me to go through it in depth, but I have the in-depth information for you. And I am also more prepared to give you more information later on. So I refer you now to the handout with the title of Truth About White Women and Affirmative Action in South Africa. The debate on white women and affirmative action gained new momentum after a recent proposal by the chairperson of the Employment Equity Commission, Mr. Jimmy Manji, that white females should not longer be included in the designated group. And these proposals are based on the finding of the Employment Equities Commission's report that the percentage of white females in top management positions grew to 14.7%. And that is his main source that he decided to base his whole argument on. So the question is, that's 14.7%. Is that relevant? Can one use it? Because if you can't, then his whole base is actually falling apart. Mr. Peter Mbeki, when he presented to the Reserve Bank, responded to Mandy's call by pointing out that scientific proof exists of past discrimination against white women. And I will just show you a bit about that. Mandy was supported by the Black Management Forum, of course, of which he is the chairperson. Let's look at the statistical source. He's using the Employment Equities Commission source. I'll show you that. I already checked that the place is rather very, very flimsy from the statistical point of view. And interesting enough, the most important criticism against the report of the Employment Equity Commission is, of course, from their own report. They claim they discuss their problems in the report with specifically the reporting, and then the Commission's report says this may distort any interpretation and conclusions made about representation of the designated group in the workforce. So the fact of the matter is the Employment Equity Commission actually is saying our report may distort any interpretation and conclusions. Don't use that from a scientific debate. But the chairperson of the Employment Equity Commission decided, no, I will use this as the sole reason to make this kind of important national recognition of white women. I show you here around a bit of what's happening if you have anomalies, and I have a graph in here to show you this typical anomaly that happens if your data is not reliable. And that's interesting enough. The one anomaly that you can see is the white women in 2006. That's a specific stat. You will see that there's a graph rising suddenly, and no explanation. There was a steady graph suddenly one year going up. And interesting enough, it was also a graph that came out of the 2006 reports. And the 2006 report is exactly the report that has real problems at this stage, because 2.5 times more reports than in 2005, but much less employees are covered. A very, very funny kind of stat in 2006. So I must say that the year which they use at this stage are a very flimsy year. You simply can't do that. You will also see that the dilemma, of course, you all know it. You know the Employment Equity Act. Every second year there's a different reporting, five above 50 and less than 150, and then the other year above 150. That makes also comparisons very, very difficult. Then, of course, only around 28%, or approximately 1,540 of the average of 5,478 submitted reports related to the same employer. So that means you can't do this kind of comparison that the Employment Equity Commission does. It's only 9.82% of the workers that in South Africa that is covered. Then we have a big problem of non-submissions, and especially state departments are guilty of that. I'll show you, also give you all of that stats. And of course that will have influence. We've just seen what the transformation in the state departments look like. So if a lot of them don't report, then it will have influence at the end of the day. There's also numerous technical and computation errors that we've identified, a lot of that. But that's not that important, like if you look at the broader problem, but it's also in the SICA report. Then let's look then at the white women issue. The fact of the matter is that the whole debate is skewed. These white women that we talk about that are affected by this, only 1,200 white women. So the whole debate that we have at this stage is about 1,200 white women in top management positions, simply not acceptable to do that. But if you look at the different statistical field bases in South Africa, the one is a labor force survey from South Africa, very comprehensive kind of survey. And if you look at the Employment Equity Commission's statistics at this stage, there's a 50% discrepancy between the number of white females in the labor market between the two statistical sources. So something is wrong. One specific source must be wrong. I must say, if you look at the labor force survey, a much more comprehensive source, I have more, I'm relying much more on that. So this is in the first place. If you look at the statistical base that is used, then I say there's something wrong. You can't make, as a commission committee, a national decision on this kind of flimsy statistics that we have here. It's simply not possible. I think it will be irresponsible. But let's go then a bit back. And we say to ourselves that why females were included in the designated group. One has to establish why females were initially included as a separate category in the designated group, and in addition to females, persons with disabilities. The first categories are based on race, Africans, colors, Indians. They are clearly part of the designated group on the grounds of race-based discrimination. The remaining two categories, that females and persons with disabilities, are included on the basis of discrimination and gender and disability grounds. In other words, discrimination on grounds other than race. And that's important. They are there for discrimination on other grounds than race. And suddenly, we are in a racial debate about gender. These are the two grounds there which Tikumbuku Wendy refers, and not race. He actually said there was discrimination on other grounds against white women than their race, namely their gender. In order to determine whether white females had suffered discrimination on the grounds of gender, we looked at the percentage of white females in the white group as a whole, just to see if they actually was the discrimination against white women. And then you will see quite clearly in the next graph, you will see the percentage of whites in the total group, and the reason why we've done that to show you that they are far underrepresented also in the white group. To say that their discrimination is addressed is simply not true if you look at them in the group. White females remain underrepresented on the grounds of the gender. There appears to be a strong growth in terms of white females against white males, but this is largely due to the significant decline of white males in the labor market. And you can look at the broader, the SICA report, everything is in there. Mungie degrades the gender debate to one of race. He simply looks at the racial figures and on the strength of these decides that white females should be excluded from the designated group. The Black Management Forum stance is also based on race. The organization's name reveals its point of view. Affirmative action in terms of females is not a race issue, it's a gender issue. The question is whether the factors that impede gender equality in South Africa have been removed, and racial percentages cannot possibly provide the answer to this. Let me bring you then to the fourth point, gender equality and affirmative action. So I then try to determine what happens with the movements if it comes to gender equality in South Africa. The shocking part of this is, you will say, if you look at women as a total, black and white women, you will see there's a 2001 to 2006, that includes black women. There's also a decline of black women in the workplace. So it seems that there is something wrong with gender equality in South Africa. And the problem at this stage, we are so obsessed with race at this stage that we forget about gender equality. And we can see this in the stats. On the racial side, especially the male side, we actually progressed quite well. Huge growth on black males, huge decline on white males. But if you look at gender, it's not so. If you look at white women as a total, you see a decline in percentage of the total of 24.83%. So white women are quite clearly the group that was the hardest hit in the labour market from 2001 and 2006. And now, Mr. Munji said exactly the opposite in the newspaper. I assume you also see it here. Let's look things up, and I will do that very briefly. From management, you will see that there was a huge growth. Because of a low percentage base, you must understand that, of black women and Indian and colored women, white women also grew. If you accept that the 2006 stats are acceptable, then you see there's a growth of white women, but I have a question about the stats, but if you say that the stats is okay, then you will see white women is actually the group, the gender group that actually grew the next. They actually grew much less than the other groups. Just a point to take note of. I see Mr. Manji said that the ratio between white and black women is 1 to 3. Simply not true. Look at the statistics, it's 1 to 2, interest sake. Senior management, you will also see the same day, white women grew, but much less than the rest. So it's simply not acceptable. If you look female professional qualified, white women actually decline by 0.86%, page 12, sorry about that, I move fast. White women declined by minus 8%, but look at that as well. Female skilled technical people. African women, a decline of 54%. A decline of 54% of the percentage of the rate. What I want to argue here is there's a problem with gender equality in South Africa. And we, I will say something more about semi-skilled. You will see also there a decline on women generally, but white women, the biggest decline, 42%. And skilled white women, 36%, if you look at the rate. So the fact of the matter is, there's simply no truth in the statements of Jimmy Manji that white women are the most beneficiaries of the designated group. I can't believe that he says that and he simply comes away with it. He's supposed to be much more objective. But, Madam Chair, and then I'm very near to my end now. Case law. We are busy here with a debate about white women and affirmative action. But there's clear case law on this. The court already judged that white women are at the bottom of the affirmative action plan. They, in the Fourie versus South African Police Service case, a white police officer argued that she had suffered race-based discrimination, and then the judge found that I accept that white women were discriminated against under apartheid, but not to the same extent as black people, and particularly African people. So actually, case law already crystallized this, the whole debate. So case law actually says that white women must be part of the designated group, but they are already behind in the ranks. Right or wrong, I have argue on that, but I don't want to argue with the court at this stage. But the fact is, actually, the thing that we are debating at this stage are already crystallized in case law. So my question is, what political gains one wants to achieve through still debating this specific point? Okay. South Africa and gender equality. And this is, for me, maybe the most important part of my presentation. How does South Africa fare when it comes to gender equality? And Chair, this is for critical importance for this specific committee. This committee must make sure that the different ILO, the relevant ILO... Okay. Okay. The International Labour Organization has clear resolutions on gender equality. And especially on issues like, there was a comment here about family responsibilities of workers, I think in the previous presentation. There's clear resolutions on that. And that resolution is actually focused on gender equality. For instance, the Maternity Protection Convention C183 and the Recommendation 191, Workers with Family Responsibilities Convention C156 and the Recommendation 165, and there's other as well. I refer also in here. Has the question is, has the South African ILO delegation ratified this convention? The answer is a resounding no. They did not. So the problem at this stage is we are not in line with international resolutions if it comes to gender equality. We see it in the stats, but now we are playing race games through focusing on white women. There are no fewer than 22 ILO conventions and recommendations that specifically promote gender equality. South Africa rectified, I think, if I remember correctly, the two important ones is 111 and 101, the one is equal work, equal pay, and discrimination. If I, and we've rectified those because that's fundamental conventions, but okay, we did not. And that is the responsibility of this portfolio committee to look at that. Solidarity hereby gives formal notice to the portfolio committee that it intends petitioning Parliament to ratify and implement international labour regulations. The petition will also ask for public hearings at which gender equality issues may be discussed. Our gender desk and the chair and leadership of Elena Barry will drive this, and you will, of course, the labour petitioning will go through this committee, so you will definitely receive at some stage a proper petition on this. And that will actually force the portfolio committee also to look at this. In summary, the debate about white females and affirmative action is based on spurious statistics. The Employment Equity Commission's report cannot be used in isolation in determining of national policy. The entire debate has its origins in a single statistical anomaly concerning an unusual occurrence in 2006. As a matter of fact, the statistics for 2006 are generally questionable. It is admitted in one of the Employment Equity Commission's reports that these reports cannot be used as a basis on which assumptions are made for the designated group. The debate on white females and affirmative action in concerns were from here 1,200 individuals. Given the disputable statistics offered by the Employment Equity Commission show that the total white female representation has declined by approximately 24%. With the exception of a single category, white females' representation showed slower growth and declined faster than all other racial groups. A debate on white females and affirmative action will not resolve the gender equality problem in South Africa, but that is what may be expected if race is allowed to dominate the debate about gender. Jimmy Manji has effectively diverted the attention from his commission's inability to promote gender equality by indulging in a nonsensical debate about white females and affirmative action. He has diminished the gender debate to a race debate. South Africa has failed to ratify important ILO conventions dealing with gender equality. This sends a negative message to South African workers about our country's commitment to gender equality. Courts have already resolved the issue of white females and affirmative action by finding that females about, although not the primary victims of discrimination, that suffer disadvantage and remain part of the designated group. The debate of women and affirmative action is contagious, one that unleashes racial emotion and that does not promote gender equality. This debate must be secondary to the need for gender equality. Those who argue that white women should no longer form part of the designated group do so from a decidedly shaky platform and are guilty of fanning dangerous racial emotions. Mr. Manji's regular and substantial racial utterances raise questions about his suitability as chairperson of a commission that is meant to promote equality and non-racialism. The portfolio committee should explore the hypothesis that the chairperson of the Employment Equity Commission emotion is promoting a racially divided community rather than a non-racial labour force. And, Chair, in my original presentation that I sent to you. I have then the final proposals, and that is, of course, you have it there with you. Just a moment.
You have half a minute.
Yes. That the employment equity report is not used as a determinant of the national policy due to the numerous shortcomings, that the status of white females is maintained, that the designated group also includes the young people entering the labour market for the first time, and that the code of good practice is developed to counter discrimination against the unfair discrimination against the non-designated group. And that is my proposal. And that is it, Chair, if you want.
Oh, I think you can walk. Thank you very much. Yeah, no, it's, we don't have time. We are still not sure if we will really try and manage this little time we have. But can I just, members, I'm sure we'll jot down all the questions or input we want to make to all these presenters. But can I just give Constantine, and can you just come in and introduce your team? And I hope that sort of, maybe if you are, I think there are enough chairs for you, but if you want to come up there, you can. Some can remain at the back. And I'm sure in introducing them, I'm sure they are, it's according to the... As your affiliate, you'll state which affiliate is there. So this is the community access time.
Comrade Chairperson, we're just waiting for the Prakashni Governor.
Just a point of procedure further on. We've had the last few weeks' presentations, and the practice was that we would have discussions or questions. We seem to be deviating from that practice now. Do you intend that we take the two labor unions together after Kusati's presentation, or what is the arrangement?
Yeah, I actually propose that we take them all and try and to try and manage time. But you can suggest. Are we going to take the discussions of the two unions, the Solidarity and Kusati? And then give to the Age Law Project also 5 minutes of one of the individuals. Before you, Prakashi. Mandriya.
Yeah, Madam Chair, in answer to your question, I would propose from my side that we stick to the practice that we've adopted so far for consistency and I think also fairness. Because, you know, there's a lot of information packed into presentation. If we have another one full of information, we might get confused or forget some of the salient issues that were raised. So I propose we stick to the...
But I think I've realized that during question time or discussions, we use more time and forget that there are still other presentations. But I'm all yours. Dajem, Zo, and then Dajem.
No, thank you, Shepard. I'm an ANC MP. Can I also say that our position is that we want to take this report as noted. We are not discussing the report of Solidarity now. There are too many involved things that are stated that we still want to go back and look at them. We don't want to enter that debate now. So we don't have questions for Solidarity.
Babunene?
Chairperson, I don't know, maybe I'm also sure we are thinking alike. Because I wanted to propose that before they leave the floor. Then we need to note it. Then we'll discuss it in our committee.
I think that doesn't stop some members if they would want to have an input for Solidarity. I don't want Solidarity to say they their presentation was not important. All presentations are important, and if we don't have questions, it doesn't mean that we are going to stop there. That will be discussed during the interrogation or within the committee itself. So I don't want anyone to feel otherwise. Mr. Jandun.
Chairperson, I don't want us to suppress Mrs. Dreyer. I would propose that maybe she has got something that she wants to questions that she wants to pose to Solidarity. Is it possible that we can allow her?
Yeah, I'll allow her during after consulting, because that was her proposal that unless you say you say you want to do it now, Dreyer. But really, since last week we've been taking maybe one or two, then from there discuss the issue. Do you want to do it now or later, after?
Madam Chair, my point is a point of procedure. I want to just make sure that this is...
I have just informed you that we are not starting with this presentation. Last week, we took one to two presentations and discussed. If you want to talk about this, let's not talk about procedure. We are following the procedure we took. We haven't really got out of the office, Mrs. Dreyer.
Madam Chair, I'm not fighting with you. I'm just clarifying my point that I was making. Because
do you want to do it now or later?
I actually don't have questions from my side. It's very crystal clear to me. Thank you.
Can I, Prakashan?
We just one point that we want to make in distinction. I mean, CASATRI is a federation, and we understand that we will comply with the procedures that the committee follows or determines. But we do think it's important for, if there are questions, they need to be differentiated between CASATRI and Solidarity, because our inputs are very different.
Okay. No, all right. How do you want to take it,
Okay. I think the problem that's been stated here is that there might be a concern that, or the message that we might be sending out is that the one presentation could be a dilution of the other one. And I think the concern that Honourable Dreyer is raising is the fact that we do not want to create the impression to the outside world we are playing off two presentations against each other. So I accept what you've said, that in past weeks there has been combination of two or three, but normally that would have been very similar. And if we can get the assurance that that's not the case,
then the same thing was that, then I would agree, really. Yeah, indeed, it's like that. Do you have something?
If we could just record then that this is just for practical reasons and for no reason whatsoever.
I just want to check from Mr. Speech, what practical reason is he talking about? And let me just try to emphasize the point that our whip raised from the ANC study group. And this issue I raised it late, earlier on. That if you have these two presentations, this one is in page 9. Is talking about discriminated against, and this one is in page 14. It's talking about this one is talking about one white woman, and this one is talking about one Mr. Foray. There's no clear issues that we want to get from this presentation. Issues that we want to get, Madam Chair, earlier on I said, it is discrimination at a workplace. And if you look into these two documents, there's nothing
was can I stop you then, Dati? We will continue with that debate during the engagement of all the presentation. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for this opportunity. Before I proceed, let me introduce my fellow comrades from the different unions. Before you is a delegation from Satao, MUM, Nehao, and Santu. So my name is Kenneth Mtuma. I'm with the Kusatu Parliamentary Office. On my immediate left is Comrade Fred Gona from NUM. Next to him is Comrade Jackson Simon from Satao, and followed by Comrade Tembi and Kaba from Nehao. And finally, the last two is Comrade Aziza from Sato, and the head of the parliamentary office, Comrade Prakashni, governor. Now, obviously, Comrade Chairperson, one of the problems that we've had with the time allotted is that this topic is of immense engagement, that in 30 minutes we would not be able to put before the members of this committee the issues that we are receiving from the unions, particularly in terms of the requirements of this committee to want to touch base with the ground experiences. So what we are going to do during these submissions is a very quick overview. I'll be doing a 10-minute overview of the understanding of employment equity that exists on the ground level, the experiences, and I think the committee must touch base with the experiences of unfair discrimination. I had the department prior to us coming on board asking who is discriminating against who. And there seemed to be a bit of confusion from the department. And we will make it very clear in our presentation who is discriminating against who, whether in terms of race, whether in terms of gender. So those issues are very important at our heart during this presentation. We will also look at the compliance with the various equity employment processes, whether these processes are just existing on the piece of legislation, whether they're being complied with by management of various companies. I think it's important that we put that across to the members of this committee. And then one or two issues regarding compliance mechanisms, whether there really is any compliance under this Act, whether it is, how would you say, the carrot approach is helping us, or whether the fines that exist under the EEA are actually causing the employers to be able to comply with its provisions. Just to start off, I'll make it very clear that the submissions that we're making are based on a spot survey that has been conducted. I had Solidarity before us talk about, criticize the CEE report that was complied. And I was looking to see whether there's been an attempt also for them to touch base with their various situations in the workplace. And I just want to say from the onset that COSATU contacted various affiliates nationwide to try and get data to be able to present to the committee. So that is one of the foundations of this submission. The other two are research studies that we've conducted. COSATU was a survey of 2006 where one of the questions that was being asked was in relation to discrimination, and also a WFP project that was conducted on firm workers that brings out particularly horrific stories of gender discrimination being suffered by the women farm workers, the women that are working on the farm. We've also conducted two workshops under the auspices of the Western Cape Provincial Office, the COSATU Western Cape Provincial Office, that gives us data on what the experiences are on the ground level. So to quickly summarize and present the general trends, and then the comrades that are with me in this delegation will provide specifics on their sectors. So to quickly summarize, what do we perceive as the level of understanding of EEE? In a very short nutshell, that the level of understanding is very low. Other than that notice board that you see pinned up in different places on the EEE legislation, there has been no training, no awareness programs in many instances. The workers do not know what EEE is. Some of this has even caused confusion within the designated groups, with some of the people saying that EEE is for Africans, others are saying it favors. There is basically no communication on ground level.
in terms of management, and my fellow comrade from NUM will clarify on this issue, there is still hostility that exists to this legislation. And as Nehao will point out shortly after this, even when this hostility is not evident directly from management, it has been replaced by a kind of going through the motions. Basically, let's have this committee moving, but let it not yield results. These are the things that we would want to point out to this forum. The other thing, of course, if we are asking questions whether the discrimination is still going on or who is discriminating against the other, it will be very clear that we still have race-based discrimination. This was the feedback that we were getting from the ground level. We will give examples. Sutau will give examples from the security sector. Recently, we had a dispute declared also by Sutau in relation to South Africa Airways Technical, and those examples will show there is no question of who is discriminating against who. In the mining sector, we'll find that there are very horrific things that are still proceeding that make you think whether we have just a piece of legislation or we are living actually in prior 1994 situation. And those things must be brought out clearly for the committee to be able to see. Gender discrimination, there is still, of course, the scenario that we are faced with of the gender division of labor, that certain professions are still seen as male-dominated professions, and we do not have a representation just on the basis of that social interaction. But all in all, and this will speak to the debate that has been here on white women, it is very clear that in terms of representation, in terms of the equality, the employment equity that should be realized in the workplaces, the feedback that we are getting is that less and less black women are actually being recruited into promotions. We will give quotations from some of the comrades and what they were telling us on the ground, that increasingly these top positions are being preferenced for white females. And I think that is something we are not ready to shy away from, because it is what we are getting from our grassroots, and we must speak to that. The farm workers issue, we've already mentioned that we're having serious gender discrimination problems in terms of farm workers. And I think to build up on these blatant cases of discrimination, we also have to look at other forms of indirect discrimination that in a subtle manner proceed from the Act. If you look at, for example, the provisions of the Act, Section 20, when it talks about suitably qualified people and the defense to discrimination which is implied in inherent requirements of the job. A lot of frustrations that we are experiencing from the workers is how these provisions are now being used to keep persons from the designated group to ascending to the positions that they should normally qualify for under the provisions of employment equity. And one of the proposals, we'll discuss this towards the end, is how these terms, how guidelines can be provided to these terms instead of leaving a window for employers to bar persons from the designated groups in the pretext that they are not suitably qualified or they do not have the inherent requirements to fulfill the job at hand. There will also be examples that we will talk to where some companies are now hiding behind terminology and using terms like transfers instead of recruitment to make sure that the position is not an EEA position where the designated groups can benefit from. We all have come across through the media of these cases of window dressing. It is a real thing. We have heard it from our workshop stewards from the ground level, and the whole thing of giving black people a position, or in some cases giving a certain woman a position, but then not giving them the power that goes with that position. This is obviously very clear discrimination, the whole scenario of
a CEO, chief operating officers now being appointed once you have a black person appointed as a CEO. So this is something else that we need to point out. If you look at figure 35 also of the CEE's report, it's on 34, you'll also see that in terms of promotion, that a lot of those promotions that are detailed there relate to non-permanent jobs. COSATU's position is very clear when it comes to non-permanent employment. A lot of these jobs have no security. The amount of pay is not equal to those that their counterparts are earning in permanent jobs. Surely, this is also a form of indirect discrimination. If we look at the processes as they exist, starting off with the EEC committees, the feedback that we're getting is in many instances, these committees have not been established. The comrades from Leha will show that this is not only limited to just the private sector, but even in the public sector, in some of those departments that should be pushing the agenda of employment equity, even these EE committees have not been established. We are also experiencing a lot of frustration on the membership of those committees. Some cases, they have blatantly refused union shop stewards to be part of those committees. We had a data that gave us that, where the management simply dictates who is going to be there. In another case, a certain a woman was told to sit there and represent the disabled people. She is not disabled herself. So, I mean, these are some of the problems when we get to the membership of those committees. And you may or you may not be aware that there are frustrations that are being experienced from conservative unions colluding with the people in those employment equity committees. That must be told. So that the work, the output, the result of those committees is hindered because of some kind of indirect or informal collusion. This is some of the data that we were beginning to get. In terms of consultation, no one really knows what this term means. What is consultation? We asked various shop stewards, we asked various organizers how this was being interpreted. Some of them went as far as telling us what management tells us is consultation is, I have told you, and now I am proceeding to do what I have told you. Surely, we need some kind of guidelines to be able to substantiate this to us. Even where there is a consultation, we as the unions or the workers that sit on those EEC committees do not have a way of enforcing that that consultation takes place. We have cases where EE reports go all the way to the Department of Labor and the unions have no authority on altering the contents of those reports. These are problems that we have been receiving. And obviously, if you don't get it right from at that point of consultation, you can imagine the mess that we will have when we are looking at the numerical goals, the analysis. A lot of them, an analysis is conducted by a consultant. This is the feedback that we're getting. There is no cohesive involvement of workers or the union in this whole process of conducting even the workplace analysis. And the other problem, of course, is even when the management themselves, they divorce the whole process of that analysis by giving it to the consultant. The consultant comes with a finished job, and that report is what they now proceed to forward to the Department of Labor. And they say that they have consulted. This is obviously a problem. Right now, the feeling on the ground, even regarding the EE report by the unions, is that it is a management tool that we don't have the authority to alter. Department of Labor engages directly with the management. Unions are not called in that consultative process. If the Department of Labor chooses to engage with unions, it does it separately. So you don't have a tripartite consultation. It is the department meeting two people separately. And this causes that frustration, which we summarize as a feeling that we have no authority to alter this report. You'll also see from Nehao regarding the provincial government of the Western Cape, how all the process is complied with, but inaccurate information is given. So they have complied very strictly with the process, but there is
It is a sign for sure, Chairperson. I am actually winding up because I actually want to for the members of the committee to be exposed to the actual experiences. So my last issue is relating to the compliance under the Act. When you really look at the fines that are levied under the Act, particularly with the big companies, NUM will make this very clear. Those fines are peanuts. Basically, the companies in some cases, it's very laughable, but are factoring the fines as part of their budget. Now, what does that speak to when we're actually looking at the process of implementation 9 years down the line? Now, we've had a lot of issues regarding what should happen and what should not happen. But one thing is very clear. This is 9 years after the EEA came into force. And for any credible piece of statistics, whether it is conducted by this person or the other, there should be results very evident, even for the person walking on the ground to see. But I'm afraid the feeling that we are getting is that this has not translated into practical application. In terms of workers have no strength of even enforcing a lot of their rights. Not because there is no procedure stipulated there in the Act, but because of specifically how the EEA excludes class action. A lot of the workers are saying, I don't have time to follow through the whole dispute process, or I don't have money. And there is no one else who can take up these causes on behalf of the workers. Members, Chairperson, there is so much that we can discuss regarding this, but because of time, I would like to just hand over to my fellow comrades just to motivate with specifics from their sector. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I get to specifics in the mining industry, I just want to respond partly to some of the public debate on this matter by first tracing, the situation of the discrimination at workplace, that historically we had this discrimination inherent within the legislative framework before 1994. And in the advent of our democracy, then the Constitution tried to remedy the situation. If you look at Section 9 of our Constitution, and as a result, we have this Employment Equity Act and other enabling legislation to deal with this issue. And then, Chairperson, we want to make it clear that what we are dealing with is more political than just an economic matter, because it is to do with the transformation within the country. These laws are aimed to foster transformation across the industries. And equally, the resistance we get from the employers is also informed politically. Let's address, this issue of the white women, because as Labour, we feel very strongly that the reports by Employment Equity Commission and the stance that has been adopted by its chairperson is a correct one. From the onset, at the time when the Employment Equity Act was being discussed, we were opposed to the inclusion of white women as part and parcel of people that were discriminated against to form that category. The reason being straightforward, that when you look at women generally, they are opposed, they have been oppressed in threefold. One, in terms of race, two, in terms of gender, and three, in terms of the societal operation of women. But when you look at white women, they did not form part and parcel of the oppression and as far as race is concerned. They did not form part and parcel of oppression and as far as societal repressions are concerned. It's only on gender. And even there, white women who were not employed at the time, it was by choice because they could afford to do everything else that any households could do because their husbands were earning sufficiently from their workplaces. And therefore, there was no need for white women to work. And therefore, we agree fully with the chairperson of the Employment Equity Commission that white women should be removed as part of the categories of people that were formerly disadvantaged. We will show this chairperson by quoting some few direct examples from the mining industry. The first instance that we want to raise is that within the industry, generally you have workers who do work such as the artisans. And in there, there is a special amount of money that is paid to those workers to retain them in the jobs because there's now exodus of these artisans to Gautrain and others are leaving the country. They are paid an amount of some of 4,000 rand a month. This is mainly to white workers. And black workers, who are very few in that category, are excluded from this arrangement. And the reason being that not many of black workers were able to attain this skill because there was job reservation in the past and therefore training was skewed towards that direction. So that's one area. Secondly, we've got companies in areas such as Kimberley where black women, you know, are still treated today as inhuman to a point where they would be subjected to searches when they emerge out of mines. They would be searched right down to their private parts. They are searched to find whether there are some diamonds that are concealed somewhere in their bodies. White women workers are not subjected to this kind of inhuman treatment. White male workers are not subjected to this kind of inhuman treatment. Generally, again, when we look at the employment of women in the industry, you would see that the mining charter talks about at least 10% of women must have been employed in the industry in year 2009. What you find is the increase of the employment of white women at the expense of black women. If black women are employed, they would be doing, your minute work such as cleaning, sweeping, and so forth. But in actual operations, white women would be taking a center stage. Chairperson, also what we want to mention, which Comrade Kenny has raised, is this issue of renting a black, which basically means that a person can be promoted to the highest position, and this will make news headlines. For instance, if you look at Anglo Gold, a chief executive, black chief executive, was employed, but then beneath that, a position was created of the chief operations officer. Within no time, that black executive, when he raised certain issues of transformation within the company, then they found a BEE arrangement so that he can exit because they saw that they made a mistake by employing this black person. You also look at Valorant. You have a chairperson that has been employed, that has been appointed as a black person, but beneath him, immediately a position of a deputy chairperson has been created. That tells you that deliberately there is resistance to transformation. A black person cannot be entrusted with a position of responsibility. And also we're saying this, that on some of the things that might be seen as small, like in other companies, we still have companies where parking is reserved on the basis of color, irrespective of the position that the person holds. As long as you are black, you must park somewhere. The same thing goes with your tea rooms in those workplaces. Living conditions as well, because in mining, as you understand, that the workers, there are some workers that are still living within the workplace, the work premises. White workers' quarters, living quarters, are much better in terms of the size, in terms of the arrangement than those of their black counterparts. irrespective of the positions that people hold in those workplaces. And also, if you look at the matter of, you know, the retirement arrangements within the industry, you find a similar situation where white workers are provided for much more higher than those of a black color. So Chairperson, the list goes on even in terms of skills development, that there are certain categories of skills that are reserved for white people. They would cite the element of lack of adequate education on the part of the black people, disregarding completely, you know, the prior learning, the experience that the black people have acquired through their work experiences in the years of their work in the industry. So, Chairperson, we're saying this, that these things are done, I'm worried about time.
Yeah.
These things are done deliberately because there's a serious resistance of transforming the society and the industry by the employers who, by and large, are still white, because the economy of this country is still concentrated in white hands. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Fred. Is it you now? Who is coming in here?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm not going to repeat what my comrade just said. I just wanted to be specific on some few experiences that were recently even published in the media by SATAW. One of it, it was the South African Airway Technical Department, where job reservation was only meant for white people until SATAW took the matter as a matter of dispute, which only averted the strike at the last minute, where an argument was then into that drive the transformation process, establishing a transformation committee and appointment of a new executive person to drive the transformation process. The second experience is the current dispute in the same South African Airways, whereby more than 2,000 black workers are to be retrenched, while the same SAA is reserving a position for the white counterparts who are pilots, saying that those that will be affected, they will be trained to do particular jobs, while the same arrangements are not given to the black counterparts. While saying these are stories that are still alive in our society. The other issue is the discrimination in the more former Rhodesian-dominated sector, which is the private security sector, because it's still dominated by the former Rhodesian. That seems to be disregarding the human being in the certain particular black workers. We had recently few experience where you find that in some security companies, in particular, the big ones that the politicians are owning majority shares, that black workers are still refused access to toilets that are used by the white staff. And those experiences were brought to the front by SATAW through the media and so forth, but those experiences still exist. And the other one is about the discrimination against women. This is not only about companies themselves. This is including government, to some extent, part of their towns, and some security users, where you will find that the demand in the tender processes themselves, they clearly stipulated that no women are allowed to provide security service in particular areas, even in the government, which we believe that that is against the same strategy that this new government has fought against, because the discrimination of women cannot be acceptable. And further also, you will find that office staff in the security sector, no black person allowed, because it's reserved for white people only. That is where you'll find most dominated by white females, and when you get to women, black women, they will only be tea ladies and cleaners in those companies. So we're saying those are kind of experience that exist in the sectors where we operate as a union. Although we're taking up this issue. To some extent, our view is that the Minister of Labor seems to be encouraging these things because there's a continuous statement that the minister made which undermined the Department of Labor in executing itself in terms of enforcing employment equity and so forth, because the minister will always say he cannot be the senior shop steward. Unions have to deal with these issues themselves. Why? Because the legislation framework that are supposed to be monitored and enforced by the Department of Labor. And what it then that interprets to is that Department of Labor see itself as not responsible to enforce these laws, but unions themselves should be the one that monitor and enforce these laws, which we are saying those kind of statements should be avoided if we intend to implement the transformation and employment equity in this country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, madam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just before I could share some of the experiences, just to make a comment on what was said earlier with regards to discrimination, who is discriminating who. I think it is quite clear. Discrimination is one way. Otherwise, we have two legislations which deals with opposite discrimination. If discrimination was coming in opposite direction. Some of the experiences we've had on the ground is that there is a lack of coordination across departments on the public sector, you know, in proceeding and ensuring full implementation of the employment equity. And the fact that the provincial government has not fully utilized opportunities provided, you know, by various restructuring initiatives to ensure implementation. And also that the Employment Equity Act and the Code of Good Practice has, you know, prescriptive steps and measures on how to develop the employment equity plans. But you find that in workplaces, there are no employment equity committees. And where they exist, I can give an example of, you know, normally, like the comrade has echoed, you know, members will be selected on who sits in those committees. And before you can make a decision, you even have to go back, you know, to the person who's a superior, who sits in the committee to, you know, to approve your decision. We also find that, you know, in the Department of Health, it deals with employment equity in terms of its rational demarcation. It does not address equity on workplace levels as defined by the Employment Equity Act. Say, for example, a big institution with more than 50 employees will not necessarily have an employment equity committee in place because it's clustered with other institutions. So problems that are of regional are not dealt with directly. And we still see that discriminatory practices still continue at all levels in the provincial government in the Western Cape. A case in point is the number of senior managers recruited after the re-engineering of the Department of the Premier who have left. And that speaks to the environment which the re-engineering was supposed to address. But in general, you will see when positions are advertised, you know, the provincial government of the Western Cape is in line with the employment equity plan of the Western Cape, and its intention is to achieve equity in the workplace by giving preference to applicants from designated groups. We observe that the quality and the quantity of the work seems to not to match. It doesn't help to say you have employed, say, 50 African people, whereas the quality of the job they're doing does not sustain their livelihood, you know, as a working class. So we need to look also at the quality of the jobs, you know, that if there should be reports and audit reports, I mean, targets, when there should be targets that should be met, it should be at all levels, including senior levels in the department. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. You are left with 5 minutes. I don't know if Prakashish wants to talk. How are you going to share the 5 minutes? Or will it be only him?
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'm Aziza Kanamaya. And I'm speaking from the position of being involved in an industry that is really female-dominated, female-intensive in terms of employees in the clothing and textile industry. And interestingly enough, we're talking about a topic that has a lot of controversy in our industry. I think it is a fact that your Employment Equity Committee, you know, as a starting point, is not really widely established at workplace. But where we do have some, we try to make them as effective and efficient as possible. I think a couple of the issues that I want to highlight are real experiences in our industry. And as an example, when we talk about... it's on again. When we talk about our industry, you know, you can, for lack of not one of being, not finding a better terminology, our industry is really still very much white, pale, and male dominated in the hierarchy of our company. If you are fortunate enough to be promoted as a black individual, you would go to supervisory level or at a highest mid-management level where, in any event, you are not in a position to make any decisions or meaningful decisions that will transform the workplace. I think it is a fact also that in our industries, males are preferred in the higher director positions and management positions. And interestingly enough, it goes hand in hand with the wage discrepancy that still prevails in our industry. For example, if you have a female manager who is not white, she would definitely earn significantly less than a white manager is, and far less also than a male manager at that establishment. So those are the realities that we are talking about. In our industry, it's predominantly single parents, females, and not one company that we are aware of has even got anything close to childcare facilities. And that is also referred to in the employment equity. So the position of females not being promoted other than white females, the position of wages, people being underpaid because they are not white, and the facilities all go hand in hand with what gender, the chapter on gender is outlined in the employment equity. I think one of the areas that we wish to highlight as a union is the point made on disability, whether it is permanent disability or a shorter term disability, is more seen as a liability to a company. Because what is now used is, if you are temporarily disabled, you must be boarded, or you are dismissed for ill health incapacity. And that then takes the worker to another level of addressing that dispute. I think what we also want to bring to this house is, you know, there is a view or a perception that says it's legislation versus the Department of Labor versus the Department of Trade and Industry. And what would be very interesting is to see, since this act, the inception of it, you know, what resources or additional resources is being put in place to ensure compliance. Currently, the approach is unions, you complain to us as the department, and then we will come and take up that issue. That is the view, and that is if we can find an inspector or an agent of that department. But certainly the monitoring process is sorely lacking. The availability or the visibility of any inspector or any person from the Department of Labor and or Trade or Industry would be welcomed, you know, at workplaces from time to time. I think one can also raise the perception that the Department of Labor has very graciously dumped or passed the buck onto bargaining councils or unions to actually monitor and ensure compliance at the workplaces. The second last point that I would want to make, Madam Chair, is the point of the dispute resolution mechanism. The whole issue of the courts or dealing with disputes, the procedure is either seen to be very confusing, thereby meaning, do you go to the CCMA? This is what workers are confused about. Is it a CCMA matter? Is it a labor court matter? Or is it an equality court matter? And that in itself demoralizes the ordinary worker. It is not only time-consuming, but it becomes very costly. And therefore, it's not really a worker-friendly process or procedure that can be followed. I think it is the fact that in our industry, the only group that has benefited from this piece of legislation is the white woman. As a convenience, but it has really benefited them. Currently, the piece of legislation, Madam Chairperson, with all due respect, is more seen as a nice to have. And I want to make the point that health and safety, employment equity, and the like, it's a nice to have legislation, but almost impossible to implement or to monitor or to address. And I want to state two very clear examples. In one example, it is more a health and safety issue where a worker was burnt to death because the door was locked and he couldn't get out and the factory was burning. Another worker in a clothing company in a very rural area lost her twins because the employer didn't trust them enough to leave and exit, and she lost both babies. The ambulance services or doctors couldn't get into the premises, and therefore when they eventually got the place open, the one baby had already died and the other one died on the way to hospital. So these are the kind of real, real issues that workers are facing in relation to the different legislation. And we are bringing this to the fore because we are really hoping that whether it needs an in-depth look at what has been achieved over the last 8 years is very little other than a piece of paper which is perceived by the ordinary worker as a nice to have but of little benefit to them. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Kenny. Members, we are going to take this last but not least, the AIDS law project, and then from there we will have discussion after the other 5 minutes of one of the individuals. But thank you very much for coming. You have given us a picture, I would say a clear picture of some of the issues that we were really doubtful, but I think your presentation will assist a lot. Can you be seated at the back for some questions of clarity and input? Can I take now the AIDS Law Project? Mr. Pretorius and Ms. Pretorius. Fatima Hassan. If you can just introduce yourselves and then,
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Committee for this opportunity to make a submission. My name is Fatima Hassan. I'm a senior attorney with the AIDS Law Project, and with me, my colleague Jan Pretorius, also an attorney with the AIDS Law Project. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, our submission is not sufficiently detailed. We have made written copies available for the committee. We specifically have not dealt with the issue of incapacity and in-house and the problems that we've experienced there, but we are available at the request of the committee to supplement any possible parts of our submission. Our submission is limited only to the issue of HIV/AIDS workplace discrimination and thus the issue of health-related discrimination, and we will be jointly presenting the submission. By way of introduction, may I point out four things on the chairperson. The first is that there are about 5.5 million people living with HIV/AIDS in South Africa. The second is that it's estimated that 1 in 5 economically active people are actually living with HIV in South Africa. The third is that we are witnessing increasing levels of unfair discrimination against people living with HIV and AIDS, and high levels of ignorance despite a very strong legislative framework that provides specific protection for people living with HIV. And the fourth is that we are seeing increasing instances of indirect HIV testing, and this appears to be gaining ground despite the prohibition in the Employment Equity Act against mandatory pre-employment HIV testing. And as our comrades have mentioned, South African Airways before, I'll take liberty to say that in particular the indirect HIV testing appears to be mainly happening at South African Airways, which is a fair state. I'll now hand over to Dan and then I'll deal with the recommendations on indirect HIV testing. Thank you.
Fatima talked about the legal framework, and a particular aspect of the legal framework is the code of practice on HIV and AIDS in workplaces. Now, that provides for workplace policies to be developed inside workplaces, and as a result of that, it's been used effectively by a number of large employers to the extent to which, since 2002, they've provided quite extensive prevention, care, and treatment programs for low-income earning employees at no cost. But despite these positive developments, what we've been finding at the AIDS Law Project is that we continue to get a number of complaints about unfair dismissal, unfair discrimination, and mismanagement of HIV-related cases. When it comes to implementing workplace policies, they're often very patchy. They'll be implemented at the national level, people won't know about them at the branches. Or in cases where there are programs of treatment and care, for historical, because of people's experiences, people are so scared of the breaches of confidentiality that everyone in the workplace is going to find out about their condition, or they're so scared that in fact once they have revealed their status that they're going to be dismissed. But even where these programs do exist in workplaces, there's significant barriers to the uptake of those services. One of the other problems, even when there are workplace policies, is a tendency to see it as a once-a-year event, National AIDS Day on the 1st of September, or simply a case of distributing pamphlets. And the particular example, I'm not going to cover all the examples in the papers, but I will touch on one or two, is where a government employee disclosed her status at her department's World AIDS Day event. Her supervisor and the rest of the senior management were sympathetic, but what happened in relation to her colleagues was they refused to sit next to her. They wouldn't eat in the canteen with her. They asked her to wash the pen that she used to sign in with every morning, and she started getting threatening phone calls in her office telling her, go home and die, we don't want you here. When it comes to the public service, there is a national policy since 2001 that covers the whole public service. But in fact, many departments aren't even aware of the details of that. If you look at the private sector, the South African Business Council on HIV and AIDS did a study in 2004 showing that although large employers are covered and do have active workplace policies, it's the small and medium employee enterprises that don't have workplace policies on HIV and AIDS, and that's where the major problems are. The small employers seem to be ignorant about how HIV is transmitted, and they seem to have a perception that workers living with HIV are a threat to them, somebody that they must get rid of in some way or the other. Because a lot of the workers in smaller and medium enterprises are poorly paid, they aren't members of unions, they don't have job security, they don't have a lot of education, employers feel fairly safe to ignore the law in those circumstances. subject to a lot of wrong perceptions, like they perceive it to be more expensive to implement care and support programs than not to, which isn't in fact the case. In some cases, they aren't interested. In other cases, they don't understand sufficiently. They lack expertise on HIV/AIDS issues. If we look at the legal framework, there are gaps in the legal framework, and those were covered earlier in the Kusatu submission, particularly the fact that the Code of Good Practice isn't enforceable. And the Kusatu submission covered in some detail the legal position of casualized employees who are a lot more vulnerable. So we're also arguing that the question is not so much that there aren't aspects of good laws on paper, but the question is, how do you access those? How do you make them real in practice? What is the impact of the limited access to legal services? It's those people who are most vulnerable who are likely to have the least information about their rights. Where trade unions know quite a lot about HIV in a lot of aspects, a lot of trade unions aren't that well equipped to take up legal cases for members who are living with HIV. They're nervous of taking those up. So that's not a solution, a magic solution to the problem either. Non-unionized members, as well as our workers who are members of unions, suffer from the problem that when it comes to anti-discrimination cases, they often stall at the conciliation level. In fact, some employers simply ignore that, which means that the case has been shifted on to the labor court, and it's a question of if you don't have legal representation, you can't afford it, your union can't afford it, then you're stuck. There's no way you can go from there. Now, I talked about the problem with casualized workers and workers employed through labor brokers. Just to give you two key examples of those, Vitz University, where we used to be based, has a wonderful HIV policy. It offers testing, it offers counseling, it offers treatment services. They cover the staff, they cover the students, but the university engaged in a massive outsourcing program. The cleaners are outsourced, and the cleaning staff don't have any of these benefits. When it comes to the public sector, we can look at the Department of Health. The Department of Health relies on a whole lot of volunteer lay counselors. They do crucial aspects of counseling and testing inside hospitals and clinics. And if you look at the kind of criteria which the Department of Labor sets as to who counts as an employee, they meet those criteria, but in fact, they simply continue to be treated as volunteers. They get a small monthly stipend instead of a salary. They don't have access to employee benefits, and they're often hired and fired without any due process. So we would definitely support the Kusatu proposals that there should be increased regulation of labor brokers and increased funding for bargaining councils to resolve the issue.
Thank you, Deb. On the issue of indirect HIV testing, Honorable Chairperson, as you'll recall, in the early 1990s, there was widespread mandatory and routine employment-related HIV testing that led to increased fear, ignorance, and non-disclosure in the workplace on HIV. In 1998, government sought to put an end to this practice by passing Section 72 of the Employment Equity Act. Now, the section makes it very clear that HIV testing in the workplace for the purposes of appointment, promotion, transfer, benefit, anything related to the issue of job security, and which is done at the request of the employer, is only permissible under certain circumstances. And the section specifically makes it a legal requirement that the employer has to approach the labor court for authorization to conduct such testing. Given this provision and a very literal interpretation of it by many large employers, it has now come to our attention that many job applicants, so new applicants to the market, are required to provide several laboratory blood test results, including a CD4 count and a viral load test. So they're not asked for an HIV test, but their blood is actually tested for their CD4 measurement and for viral load measurement. Now, both CD4 counts and viral load tests are specifically used to indicate the clinical progression of HIV in patients living with HIV. There is simply no other medical reason why these tests would be required and are being performed knowingly by certain employers like SAA to establish a person's HIV status. and requesting and performing such acts in our submission is both illegal and against the spirit and the intention of Section 2 of the Employment Equity Act. For this reason, we request, Honourable Chairperson, that the committee specifically address in its deliberations and in its recommendations to the legislative drafters that the penalties for violating Section 7.2 must be increasingly made more stronger. So, given the submissions that both Dan and I have presented, the AOP proposes the following, and there's four main recommendations, and then we'll sum up. Government, which has committed itself to the joint NABAC task team of implementing the National Strategic Plan on HIV/AIDS 2007 to 2011, which was accepted by Cabinet in May of this year, should specifically commit to combining resources and taking collective action to address the HIV epidemic through four things. The first is increasing education programs on HIV prevention and testing in the workplace, a universal rollout of ARV treatment services, including access to post-exposure prophylaxis, PMDCT and chronic ARV treatment in the workplace, programs in the workplace to eliminate HIV-related stigma and discrimination. We simply cannot live in a society where people in 2007 are still refusing to sit next to people living with HIV or to use their pen. And then fourth and finally, programs to mitigate the socioeconomic impact of the HIV epidemic. Secondly, we believe that the adoption and proper implementation of HIV workplace policies is important for ensuring access to education, testing, medical treatment, and prevention of discrimination in the workplace. We therefore propose that HIV workplace policy should become a legal requirement and appropriate mechanisms introduced to monitor the adoption and implementation of such policies should be introduced. While this would require an amendment to the Employment Equity Act, the provisions for monitoring should be structured in such a way that they are not made onerous or cumbersome for smaller or medium-sized enterprises. The amendment to the Act could simply provide that all employers should have a policy in place based on the already existing Code of Good Practice issued by the Department of Labor, but with the flexibility to amend the guideline in consultation with employees, especially trade union representatives, and to be appropriate to the particular workplace in question. And there are several possible monitoring mechanisms available, and obviously discussion with all the stakeholders would be necessary. But two possibilities, for example, would be requiring in the employment equity reports that are submitted to the Department of Labor for companies to also report on the implementation of HIV/AIDS policies, not simply the existence of HIV/AIDS policies. And secondly, large corporations, parent staples, and government departments could, for example, make an HIV workplace program, one that successfully implemented a procurement requirement. Thirdly, we believe that the penalties in cases where employers found to have violated the provisions of the Employment Equity Act relating to unfair discrimination in general, but in particular on HIV/AIDS, as well as the provisions relating to HIV testing, given the increase in indirect testing in many workplace settings, should actually be strengthened. In other words, where an employer is found to have conducted indirect HIV testing, it must be heavily penalized, particularly because such practices go against the grain of the Employment Equity Act. And then finally, in terms of access to legal services, the Legal Aid Board has recognized the importance of extending its capacity to provide assistance for civil litigation matters, including labor matters, to employees, including people living with HIV/AIDS, but its efforts are being hampered by its funding situation. We therefore ask that the committee ensure that increased funding is made available to the Legal Aid Board for particular labor matters that involve unfair discrimination, including acting specifically in cases for farm workers and for domestic workers who, in our experience, bear the brunt of HIV discrimination on a daily basis. And then finally, we support the SARC's proposals with regard to amendments to the labor law to provide increased protection of vulnerable categories of employees, including people living with HIV/AIDS. We thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Members, we will go until half past because the plenary starts at 3 today. But I am sure you'll agree with me that it was good to have the AIDS Law project to present looking at their presentation. I won't have much to say on that, but thank you very much. We will look at your proposals. And I have promised to give one of the individual people here. Well, of course, it's only 5 minutes, then we take questions. If for those who are pressed with time, we have lunch outside, but we only have 30 minutes. If you can just be with us for 30 minutes of engagement to all these presentations. Tata, give me kanje 5 minutes, and we must call a long booty day of the presentation meeting. Over to you, sir.
Okay, of course, Mama Jambalela. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I know everybody's hungry and tired. I'll just give 3 minutes. My name is Willem Kurt. I'm not a member of any political party or affiliated to any organization. I just submitted my thoughts on discrimination to the committee, and thank you for Parliament to give me a chance to talk as an individual. My working background is in the hospitality industry, in the private sector at management level for the past 13 years. I also served as director on the board of a privately owned company for 8 years until 2005. That is one of the major players in the South African tourism industry. At this level, I felt a lack of sincere commitment and understanding for transformation from white bosses. I read long ago that you can only understand and respect another culture if you live it. I believe this to be true. I've been living in Khayelitsha full-time for 5 years now, by choice. I told you this because I believe I have a view of my own, where I come from, and if you look at where I am now. The past year I've worked at different companies at general worker level by choice. I have yet to find a company where I do not see racial discrimination. This is racial discrimination against our brothers and sisters and fellow South Africans. Of all the unfair discrimination, the one that I find the most hurtful and very important is racial discrimination against black South African citizens. It is a racist issue carried over from the past and is strongly present with white bosses. Ignorance and preconceptions are factors that contribute to this disease in the workplace. Unfortunately, most black South Africans suffer the fateful disadvantage of being judged, labeled, and placed in the weakest position before they even enter the workplace. The biggest contributing factors, in my view, is the lack of trust and belief by white bosses in black people. I acknowledge the very slow growth of black people at management level, as stated yesterday by Lusa, but why do I always see a white owner and manager, or a manager at senior level? After him, I see a color supervisor, and at the bottom, I always see the black workers. Why do I always see educated black workers cleaning floors for 20 years? Because they have a heavy Khoza accent when they are trying to talk English. Why do I also see a trend of favoritism towards workers coming from the rest of the African continent above our South African black people? My list goes on. The majority of management is white, which puts them in a powerful position to wrongfully discriminate and manipulate. Yesterday, I did not hear Busa reporting on the percentage of black ownership on the JSE. I'm not talking about percentage of increase of black people at executive level. I'm talking about percentage of increase in black ownership on the JSE. I believe the percentage is actually down since 94, from 7% to 2 or 3%. Is it not possible that white bosses are sitting on their money and positions gained over decades on the back of a racist system? It's time for legislation to aid the resistance and transform the resistance to transformation. and considerations for redistribution is something that I believe in. EE and skills development are often used as tools by white bosses to just window dress the business as non-racial. Socio-economic factors, living conditions, and cultural differences do get the attention from bosses, but it is just not fully understood and respected. The root of racism and wrongful discrimination is very, very deep. It's not understood by many. It is entrenched in the white structures of too many companies. It is easy to appoint a black member on your board or give a general worker a frame certificate and a photo for 20 years of service. But it is very difficult to change the attitudes towards true empowerment and genuine transformation. With high levels of unemployment and fear of being replaced, often to keep quiet is the only way if you are a black South African worker and a victim of racial discrimination. I think the Department of Labor has big challenges and legislation that can assist transformation in a meaningful way should be a consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was Mr. Willem Kort. Members, I wonder if we shouldn't just stretch our legs 2 minutes, stretching our legs, then we go for questions, or should we break for lunch or grab something, come back for questions? Lunch, can I get direction? Should we get it over and done? And eat afterwards, even not stretching our legs for 2 minutes. Not okay. Can we go? Ndata Anthony, those cannot come around. Can you come and sit here for a while? I want to stretch my legs for 1 or 2 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Gote, and all presenters and. And of course, I said that we have representatives from the department, from the Directorate of Employment Equity, Mr. Singh and Mr. Masilo with us. Can we now go for questions and that you can just take over?
No, thank you, Jefferson. Members, I will not waste time, but open the floor for questions or comments. I noted Mr. Nene, Ms. Rajwali, Zuleki. Any other hand? In that corner.
Thank you, Jefferson. And thank you for all the presentations, which were quite a good informative report. On the solidarity, I think I haven't got a question there, because I think the input or the presentation was mostly confined to respond on the chairperson of the commission. Therefore, I think we are going to discuss that in our in committee. To Costato, there is only one question. So I would like to know what mechanism is Costato going to enforce, especially to the monitoring of implementation of this EEA, especially in training the shop steward, because from the presentation it appears that there is no enough training, especially to the shop steward, because my understanding is that the champion or the facilitator who should educate the workers or making awareness should be Bishop Stewart. I'm saying that I've been visiting some establishment where I used to see that even the Bishop Stewart are not very clear about this act or police. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to also welcome the presentation, and I think it has been well received by the committee. Firstly, I want to say to Kosaku that it just gives us a great pleasure in hearing that all organizations are getting together and starting to fight issues in the forefront. I think this should have been done many years ago. Coming from the workers' field sector, I want to say I served in sector for 20 years as a shop steward and 20 years as an organizer. It gave me 40 years in sector. And that was in my days. But after my retirement, I got into politics, so here I am. But I will not differentiate politics to bread and butter politics, because I think they go together. To SACTU, I want to say that you are still going through the battle that I have been through. And my question is that do you wait for presentation, or do you take up the matter, or what are you doing in respect of letting the employers know the do's and don'ts and rights and wrongs? And have you got any manpower or women power in place to go and monitor whether to see that the employers are actually implementing the laws that has been laid down, and are they applying our constitutional law in respect of discrimination at workplace? That is really and truly hurting. Chairperson, I don't want to take much of the time, because from the time I came back from our other meeting here, I followed the presentation. I think most of the presentation has been actually thrown to the committee. And I think the committee needs to meet on its own. And we need to discuss this whole matter. And if need be, we might call the representatives again to say that we need your input on certain matters. And we need to stand together with all the organizations and face this this elephant that is trampling us non-whites. Sorry, I'm not a racist in the workplace, especially discriminating our non-whites. And to Kosatu, I want to say, keep up the good work. And I think you should be recruiting more organizations that are related to workers in South Africa. Thank you.
Just before Honorable Mzondeke, we will request that the union take this question so that we will give you the opportunity to respond to this question. I hope you are taking the question that I directed to. Thanks. Yeah, thank you, Chairman. Let me also thank the other presenters. And it's very good for us to hear some of the challenges that are there directly at the workplace. And we want to say thank you to Kosatu that they have done some work to go to the workplace itself and to bring to our attention, because some of those issues that you've raised are going to be very important for us when we have to, you know, to deal with the report that must go to Parliament, or the recommendations that we must make, and also to deal with some of the debates that are beginning to surface. But perhaps from the Department of Labour to indicate to us whether there is no code or some guidelines that assist us to deal with this question of lack of consultation. I'm talking here with regard to the committees, your EE committees and all that, because I hear that we seem to be having problems there. Whether it is the reluctance of the union to participate in those committees, or it is not a, you know, a conducive environment being created by the employer for the unions to participate. But lastly, Chair, just to say that I've seen through all the submissions, two mini submissions, there are quite a lot of amendments that are being proposed. Now my question to all the presenters here is that, you know it's going to take a long time to come with those amendments. If we did not have these amendments, but we did have commitment by everybody, would you go any step forward? Would there be any progress? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pabum Chadi?
Yeah, mine is a comment.
Your mic, please.
Is the comment main comment mainly that because the real of traffic security is talking mainly about the working class, the problems facing the working class, and not generalizing about the working class. One has been lately listening to problems about black women, white women, black men, white men, as if all these people come from the same class. And then it will come from different classes. But yes, we can take us to our class and analyze those workers in a particular class and leave these other in a particular to see, to make it clear where we should go to today and tomorrow. But once I appreciate that, and I say it has been refreshing. I would like us to have some timing conference to discuss labor brokers and this casualization of labor. The two items are very close to my heart. Maybe because I'm a former trade union employee, I want to mention what this spice wants me to say. I know what you're this is because of the first failure is done also. But those two types are very close to my heart. I think it will be good if we can find time sometime and discuss this labor process, casualization, and all that.
Thank you very much. Pabum Koi.
No, thank you very much. No, I want also to join my colleagues to welcome the presentation from all the structures that have presented. I have some few questions.
One,
it's a general question given to you, man. That is, the statement that has been made, perhaps, or normally made by the minister to say that it's not a super shop steward in relation to the work that shop stewards are doing on the ground to assist the workers in terms of their own careers. But what is the take of the organization on some, I'm not saying all, but some of the shop stewards that are sleeping in the same bed with the bosses at the expense of the workers on the shop floor? And that makes workers to lose, you know, or unions to lose the credibility, you know, from the working class because of individuals, you know, that assist to make sure that the laws are not implemented, you know, effectively on the ground. So what are the unions saying about that generally? I mean all the unions. That is the first one. The second one is a proposal on the question of synergizing the legislation. What are these gaps and what could be done to synergize? For an example, there's the Safety Enhance, there's the EEA
there is a damage that interrelates. That makes maybe the work of transformation to be very difficult. So what are the strategy issues in those legislation that can make it to be similar?
Also, when reading all these documents, I also one document raising an issue that affirmative action must die a natural death. You know, to really agree that it must be a natural death, not a death that is being made. I'm not saying, I didn't say it's concerned. I said I read the document. It's a general question to all the presenters, that do you need to facilitate natural death, or it must be a proper natural death of that? It's talking about the question of timing. That is being there around affirmative action, whether there should be a time limit and so forth, or it must be really die a natural death, even if it has a death, but it must be a natural death, not enforced death. Because I think we need to take this debate now. The second thing is around relating the issues. I want not an ideological positioning of this issue, but the fundamental relationship between race and class, race and gender, and what difficulties are we finding ourselves in the debate today. The competing interests and the competing priorities that we put in terms of our own reformation agenda. Is race or is gender that comes before the other? How can we approach that issue, which is a competing issue, and it creates tensions. So I like those relations. The last thing, there is a proposal of dealing with the legislation in relation to young people. Whether it's correct or not. But the issue, is there any sector of these young people that is also prepared to sacrifice the interest, the inheritance? Because what's the relationship? There is those young people that inherited wealth through their own parents, forefathers, and so forth. And those who did not. When we enter that debate, are we prepared to enter the debate of sacrificing the inheritance, the inheritance that has been there in terms of wealth in relating all the youth, irrespective of color, in this particular debate? So I want us to enter those angles when we deal with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Thank you, Chief. Chairperson, on the question of affirmative action, I think we engaged on this matter during the youth unemployment public hearing, and we went further to debate the matter in the House. But it's coming up again on this public hearing. But I think it's important that we again raise this matter and put it into the right perspective. That in actual fact, affirmative action is not a proposed act now. It's not under proposed. It's not proposed at this point. We're talking about a legislation that is there, that has to be implemented. So my analysis to some of the reports here is that it is perceived as if we are proposing a legislation that still has to be implemented. We are talking about a legislation that is in place. And when we talk about women, affirmative action covers the women directly. At this point in time, as we speak, white women are covered by affirmative action. And that is why they are where they are now. There is no change in that. So that must be very clear. Because, there's one thing also that maybe we need to clarify, is that the program and the agenda of the Portfolio Committee of Labour cannot be driven by, influences from the media. And that must be changed. Because if you take the opinionist who made opinion in the media,
For instance, Mr. Mani, the opinion or the statement that he made in the meeting, it cannot be perceived as a proposal made that will amend or change any act at this point in time. It cannot. So we need to clarify those that we will not be, we are going to look at all the proposals and see how we maneuver and see how we ensure that critical issues that relate to the topic that we put as a matter for input by the public has got reached its objective. So I just wanted to clarify that, Chairperson, that in actual fact, issues that emanate from the media, from the opinion, must not be perceived as issues that will influence this committee to make a decision in favor of those opinions. Because anyone can make an opinion. The opinion of Mr. Mani can be rebutted by anyone who is opposed to it in the media. So I'm saying affirmative action itself is in place. And according to Section 15 of the Employment Equity Act, it says very clearly that affirmative action makes sure that qualified, dedicated groups, black people, women, and people with disabilities have equal opportunities to get jobs. And women are covered. I thought I would just make that indication. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very clear to show all of us. Can I give, I don't know from the department also, if, but I'm going to give anyone who wants to say something, to respond to all this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will share the questions that were directed particularly to construction and also have a bite on some of the general questions that came our way. To answer Honorable, I think, Nene, on the mechanisms that Kosatu is working on to address the issue of the monitoring of the implementation of the Employment Equity Act. Indeed, as a trade union body, we have training programs for shop stewards, ranging from the basic shop steward training to advanced shop steward training. On the category of the advanced shop steward training, we deal with a number of issues, including legislative framework. This act under question now is one of those that shop stewards get trained on. Labor Relations Act is a key act that will firmly basically target as the first law to empower shop stewards on skills development, health and safety related laws, and then so forth. So yes, we are training the shop stewards. But what we have raised in our submission is that the act itself is weighted heavily in favor of the employer, and it gives them much room for them to be able to manipulate the act. They set up these committees just for compliance purposes, with no intentions of, in the main, involving, the shop stewards and the union in the process of the implementation. And then what also we have a problem on, which is a loophole in the Act, is that when they submit this report to the Department of Labor, we don't have a say. It becomes a matter between the Department of Labor and the employer. If there is a signature there, you see some unscrupulous employers, they go to an extent of forging shop steward signatures in submitting those reports to show that there has been this interaction between the shop stewards and the employer. And indeed, the matter that we're grappling with, in some instances, we've got cases, for instance, of India that are currently at CCMA, where shop stewards in a particular plant have actually raised the fact that all the reports that were submitted to the Department of Labor, they have no knowledge of, and therefore they must be disregarded.
dead and so forth. So we're saying that hitting that score, we have that program in place. But also, Madam Chair, on the matter of enforcement, we've raised it in public, the role and the responsibilities of the Department of Labor, where we made a call that the resources must be set aside for that department to ensure the enforcement. Because it's one thing to monitor, but then it's another matter to make sure that this law is enforced by those that have got the authority to implement the law. But as we have indicated, they're having it easier. I think we mentioned here that they even budget, they even settle it in their budgetary process, the fine on non-compliance in as far as this act is concerned, because they can afford. So now what we would want to recommend to the committee is that we need to make the penalties for non-compliance to be stringent, going to an extent of looking at the possibility of revoking their operational license. Because if you look at the MPRDA, which governs, you know, the mining situation, companies, if they have not satisfied, you know, the government in terms of their transformation processes, their licenses are not renewed in the new order arrangement. This is how far down the line, you know, the government in terms of the minerals and energy can go in terms of ensuring that enforcement of this act is there. So Chairperson, we're saying this, that yes, we're training with soft stewards, and secondly, we would want, you know, this assistance in as far as making sure that the enforcement and monitoring on the part of the Department of Labor is also dealt with. And Chairperson, yes, indeed, there have been also comments that have been raised. I'm not going to answer everything, but I think, you know, there are fundamental questions that were raised in relation to the notion of the affirmative action, dying a natural death, or we must speed up the death of the affirmative action. I think, yes, it's a law, and according to one honorable member, it's there, and it will not go away. But the fact of the matter is that there are talks generally, you know, influencing the direction out there that we need to have sunset clauses, that we need to define the period within which this whole process of transformation, in particular affirmative action, must come to an end. And unfortunately for us, they don't say at what point would we see the country being transformed. At what point would we see at workplace that the transformation has taken place? Because we're still dealing with legacy of apartheid, massive legacy, in as far as apartheid wage gap is concerned, in as far as the promotion of workers is concerned, it still goes according to the color of the skin of poor people. For instance, if you look at the issue of white women, once the law is there, which we have already mentioned, the opposition has made, but that even when it was being debated as a bill, we opposed the inclusion of white women. We'll restate that, because indeed the whole question of meritorious approach is being used. Who has got the merit from a person who has benefited from the apartheid law, and the person who only in 1994 has just been integrated into society and allowed a room to advance. Therefore, you can clearly draw a line there that white people, irrespective of their gender, have been the beneficiaries of apartheid system, including the education, the type of education that they received, the type of training that they received from workplaces. Therefore, as a result, we feel that this issue of merit is used, you know, mischievously, and it's used to advance still the interest of the white community within our country. And in fact, it makes mockery of our democracy, at the position where we are currently. And the issue of, this talks also to this matter of the differentiation between philosophically the element of the gender and the race. And indeed, you locate it within this historical background, that if you look at women as a grouping, we say that women have been oppressed in terms of race, have been oppressed in terms of the class, the working class, have been oppressed in terms of gender. But when you look at white women, the two categories, they were not disadvantage in as far as their race is concerned, as well as in as far as their class is concerned, because they were located within the bourgeoisie class. As a result of inheritance that you have mentioned, and as a result of their position in society in general, they have been advantaged as a result of a particular class that was a ruling class at this stage. Yes, of course, in terms of gender, but also we say in this instance it was by choice, because those women, white women, that chose not to work, it was a matter of a family decision that you will stay at home, my dear, look after my children. But as and when the needs of the house arise, a white woman would get a job anywhere and would earn more than a black person in this country. And we are saying that is still a situation as we speak right now. That instead of then honestly the companies applying and implementing the Employment Equity Act, they've tended to choose white women over everybody else in terms of promotion and in terms of remuneration packages as well. So Jefferson was saying this, that we're still far away from reaching the goals that are basically stated in a number of transformatory laws that have been passed by this parliament. Thank you, Chair. We will hand over to other colleagues.
Yeah, thank you. You are left with 2 minutes. From there, I will give Mamkize to thank everyone who was in this boardroom, to thank especially the presenters. Prakashni?
Just very briefly, since Commissioner Fred has actually covered us in many respects. On the question of white women, just to summarize in principle what the issue is. The issue is not just about the question of representing or addressing the issue of representativity. It's about addressing the socioeconomic disadvantages that people have suffered in this country as a result of apartheid. So we cannot just, it's not just a question of people feeling affronted or insulted by the fact that we are raising the question of their status. On the question of the super ministry or the super shop steward, where the Minister of Labour is concerned that too much of the responsibility is actually being afforded to the Minister of Responsibility in terms of Minister of Labour in terms of implementation. Our concern is that our views are not enough is to be done. Obviously, where the balance lies would have to be up to negotiation. But the Department of Labor has been here in this committee reporting the failure of even, I think, the top JC listed companies who have failed to comply with reporting on income differentials, placing all the responsibility on the companies in this case. But there is an obligation on the Department of Labor to actually investigate and to set up benchmarks on reducing income differentials. And it hasn't happened. And it's a long outstanding arrangement. In terms of responsibilities for trade unions, obviously trade unions need to take responsibility because this is our membership. But we are also suffering under lack of capacity from moves at the workplace to demoralize and to disempower trade unions. And there's a shift, the comrade mentioned the question of labor brokers. But currently the terminology that's used is atypical labor, which covers labor brokering, part-time work, seasonal work, casual work, which is to shift away from permanent work with income and job security. That essentially undermines unionization and undermines our ability to actually engage at the workplace. Particularly we didn't have farm workers here, but FAO was actually unable to attend. But if you look at the stats in terms of unionization, there's a very small level of unionization, but 10 years ago, it was almost 8%, and it has dropped to less than half of that, less than 4%. Now, how do we implement affirmative action and employment equity under these constraints?
Thank you, Prakashi. From the department, we want to, just for half a second, half a minute.
I just want to respond to the one question first before I cover other areas. One, with regard to guidelines on consultation, the Department of Labor has released a number of codes of good practice over the years, and they're also available on our website. There's a code of good practice on the preparation there's a code of good practice on the preparation and implementation of employment equity plans. Included there is a section on consultation and what is prescribed. What was found further is that this was not sufficient, because although the courts may take the codes into consideration, it's not directly legally binding. So what the commission decided, to include some of those areas on consultation into the regulations. So now they are legally binding. Chairperson, the next thing I just wanted to capture something is that we deal with the operations of the law. And from our understanding is that the Employment Equity Act initially was put in place with good faith. And the result is one would have expected much more compliance. And it hasn't happened that way. Initially, one puts capacity in place to see that the Employment Equity Act is implemented properly, but it's not happening. So we would have to strengthen the mechanisms in the Act from an operation point of view. When it comes to enforcement and the compliance mechanisms in the Act, we find that we actually fall short in that particular area. Secondly, I think we need some sort of comprehensive approach where we need to strengthen our relationship, especially with employees and maybe trade unions, where participation at workplace levels in these forums could also be strengthened. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, especially those who presented earlier on the DPSD. Thank you very much for being with us for quite a long time. And those individuals also, and of course, the children, the solidarity has to give to rush back. Mom, please, can you really, as the unionist, or the used to be the shop steward, can you thank all the presenters and the guests?
Thanks, Chairperson. You know, when you say shop steward, when I was in the union, a worker came to me and said, you know, I'm going through such a lot of problems at my workplace, and I keep approaching the shop steward, and she's not helping me. I said, what do you mean? She said, yeah, I went so many times to the shop steward. And I made her sit and I said, I kept on telling her, say, shop steward, until she started saying shop steward. Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson, for allowing me to thank our presenters. I think our presenters have brought home quite a lot of food for thought, I must say. But all I can say, before I can say thank you to you, that I think we all have a lot of work to do. And with our young democracy in South Africa, I think there are certain places that we need to strengthen, especially when it comes to the discrimination part of the workplace. And I think many of our workers are stressed. Many of our workers just leave work because they say, I cannot take it anymore. And I think we should concentrate on that to say that what can be done. And the committee here, our committee, the Portfolio Labour Committee, is always prepared to stand by the organizations that should you need our assistance. We have constituency offices as well that you can approach in our constituency period. We have workers in our constituency offices that you can also take up the matter. But don't let me take you more of your time. I want to say thank you very much to all the presenters, the DPSA, the Solidarity, the COSATU and its affiliates, and to the Aid Flow Project. I think you are really working hard, and that we want to say a very big thank you to you. And as I said, our doors are open, and we need to get together more often instead of just once in a while coming to return. I want to thank you all, thank the committee as well, thank you, Chairperson, and don't forget to have something to eat before you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.